today, we see the same tactics deployed against Julian Assange of WikiLeaks fame. Assange and his collective, WikiLeaks, have been whistleblowers and transparency activists determined to bring light on government activities everywhere. Ecuador's decision to withdraw its welcome to Assange has exposed him to the venom of the American government, largely for showing U.S. atrocities back in Iraq during the war. In 2008, Greenwald writes, U.S. Army secret reports called WikiLeaks, quote, an enemy of the state, unquote, showing plans to destroy the group. And although Assange didn't work as a reporter, he compiled great amounts of data and shared it with great newspapers, which, while publishing his data, still tried to demonize him, denounce him, and question his sanity. Assange's work has shown how governments, including the U.S., really work. For that, he has earned high praise. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Okay, the view from the inside. Prison Radio, as I mentioned, they're putting up a lot of different stuff now, different other incarcerees, other prisoners giving testimony, and they have some conference audio at prisonradio.org. And they still have a call out to pressure Krasner, the progressive DA in Philadelphia, who fired something like 25 or 30 prosecutors when he first came in, swept his house out. But he had been pressured by the police, FOP, to not allow the retrial that was authorized for Mumia by a lower court to go ahead, and was going to appeal it, but he caved on it. I guess he took a lot of heat on that. I'm glad people did work on that, and there'll be a new education of adjudication of Mumia's case. It's about time. All right, 3 minutes in already. Got Amy Goodman's on deck talking about the global gag rule. A lot of good stuff. She's got a web exclusive of a tune from Pete Seeger that's coming out on a new Smithsonian collection song, as yet unpublished. Prolific Pete Seeger. I thought about playing it, but I'm going to play instead. Got an election theft report. Keys in on the Supreme Court and the citizenship question, and that we're talking about. They're starting up a regular weekly series with Greg Palast. He talks about other things too. But I played that all leading up to the whole series leading up to the last election cycle, and they've kicked it in already now. So, but first, the regular feature being Amy Goodman's commentary. I didn't mention, besides Palast, I've got a special episode of Moderate Rebels. Played some on my show last week. It's a alternate book launch. Pretty renowned bookstore in cafe in D.C. I believe it's right at DuPont Circle. Busboys and Poets was going to have a opening book chat with him, and apparently it was pressurized to not go ahead with it. They apparently did help with getting a space and getting this book start going. A couple of books are mentioned in it. Helena Cobbin, not but book title, but she's actually in the audience, and I'm going to at least try to get to the segment where she does an intervention. Managing Savagery is the name of the book. It's about blowback. It's about regime change using any means necessary. Heard that in another context, but the CIA doesn't care about what they use, drug trafficking, to sponsor rebels, et cetera, et cetera, Mujahideen, Salafi writings. They don't care. And I use this metaphor too often, but he takes a really deep dive into this. I got to get the book. But the book chat is available at Moderate Rebels Podcast. I've listened to all of it. I've got to go through the second section, which is more about the Middle East. The first part we'll hear is more about Afghanistan. I don't think there are any things I have to bleep out, which is pretty amazing. I guess maybe it's because they're in public. All right, here's Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay.
Trump's crusade against women goes global. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Before he became president, Donald Trump described himself as pro-choice. Now he can't do enough to deny women control of their own bodies. Marching in lockstep with Vice President Mike Pence and some of the most anti-choice members of his right-wing coalition, Trump has gone global in his crusade, watering down a United Nations Security Council resolution aimed at stopping rape and sexual violence in war. His acting UN ambassador threatened to veto any resolution containing language referring to reproductive health. The goal of the demand, most observers agree, is to ensure that women who are raped in war should not receive any help terminating pregnancies. This episode is just the most recent in the accelerating and increasingly successful campaign to criminalize abortion waged by a vocal, well-funded minority in this country. For close to half a century, the right to a safe, legal abortion has been guaranteed by the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade decision. For many years, the divided court consistently reaffirmed Roe v. Wade, with the surprise retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, though, and his replacement with controversial conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the balance on the court has shifted markedly to the right, and the future of Roe is entirely uncertain. Confident that the current Supreme Court would now overturn Roe v. Wade if given a chance, anti-choice activists and their allies in Republican-controlled state legislatures are pushing a new wave of anti-abortion bills. This will set the stage, they hope, for a Supreme Court decision eliminating a woman's right to privacy and to make her own health care decisions enshrined in Roe v. Wade. The extreme nature of this year's bills is unprecedented, notes the pro-choice Guttmacher Institute in a recent report. They say legislation under consideration in 28 states would ban abortion in a variety of ways. Among the slew of strategies employed are trigger bans, which would make abortion completely illegal in a state should Roe be overturned, gestational age bans, which make abortion illegal after a fetus has gestated 6, 12, or 18 weeks, or some other length of time. These are often referred to as fetal heartbeat bills. Reason bans, which bar abortion for reasons of a fetus' sex, race, or disability, and method bans, which bar certain types of abortion procedures. Add to that the TRAP, Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers laws, that impose extraordinary, cumbersome regulations, which the majority of small clinics can't afford to follow. These laws don't enhance patient safety, but force facilities that provide abortions to meet an array of onerous conditions, like having corridors of a certain width and exam rooms of a specific size. The financial costs of meeting these arbitrary regulations often force clinics to shut down. While over two-thirds of Americans are pro-choice, anti-choice activists have the edge in state governments, with Republicans controlling roughly two-thirds of state houses and 27 of the country's 50 governorships. But progressive legislators in some states are pushing bills to protect access to safe, legal abortion, enhance availability of contraception, and expand sex education. Likewise, federal courts continue to strike down the most egregious and unconstitutional efforts to control women's reproductive health decisions. Recently, Trump's Department of Health and Human Services issued what pro-choice advocates call the Title 10 gag rule, barring physicians from giving patients the full range of options when considering reproductive health. In Oregon on Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Michael J. McShane issued a preliminary injunction against the gag rule, calling it a ham-fisted approach to public health policy. Dr. Lena Wen, president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, said of McShane's ruling, "While this is a victory for patients and doctors, this relief is preliminary, and we'll continue to fight the Trump-Pence administration in court and in Congress to ensure our patients' health and rights are protected," she said. Back at the United Nations, the Trump-Pence administration has expanded the anti-choice agenda globally by removing any reference to sexual and reproductive health from the UN Security Council's resolution on conflict-related sexual violence. outraged at the U.S. position. France's U.N. ambassador said it's intolerable and incomprehensible that the Security Council is incapable of acknowledging that women and girls who suffered from sexual violence and conflict and who obviously didn't choose to become pregnant should have the right to terminate their pregnancy, he said. The U.S. administration also removed the word gender from the resolution and weakened references to the International Criminal Court, making it harder for women and girls to seek justice. Donald Trump himself has been accused of sexual harassment and sexual assault by no less than 16 women. Is this really the world leader who should be shaping global policy on sexual violence? I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, it shouldn't be Pence either. Pence is like a Cheney figure almost, I think, in behind the scenes, so a little more. We've got the Twitter spewing of POTUS, but things like this are happening anyway. So, Greg Palast, election theft report, as I mentioned, and he still asserts that the election was won by Trump in the Electoral College important states by voter suppression. I haven't read that much about the Pennsylvania, except I can imagine lots of defective and overloaded voting sites in downtown Philly, and that might have been part of it. But it's pretty wide-ranging in this instance, but like I say, it keys on this the importance of the citizenship question. And, of course, KK, crusty Kurt Kobach, comes up again because he's still looking for a position. Immigration czar got floated and shot down pretty quick, I guess. Can't get Republicans to vote for him, not even in Kansas. Kansas went Democratic just because people couldn't stand Kurt Kobach at the governor level. Chartle.
Say Dennis Bernstein twice, now it's three times. Joining us at the top of the show, and we're glad to have him back, is Greg Palast. You know, he's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and we have been doing a multi-part, multi-year series in terms of fighting for your vote. We've been calling it the Election Crimes Bulletin, because there are many crimes being committed against you. Now, Greg, let's come in. What does the census have to do with voting Chris Kobach and the next election? How about that?
Everything, and you will only hear it on the Election Crimes Bulletin. Yesterday, before the Supreme Court, the state of New York and other states challenged the Commerce Department's decision, that's your billionaire, doddering billionaire Wilbur Ross, Secretary Ross's decision, to put the question of whether you or anyone in your household is or is not a citizen. Do you have a non-citizen in your household? And so the states are arguing that Ross went to his own experts in the Census Bureau, which is part of Commerce, and the Census Bureau told him, you add that question and you will lose 6.5 million voters from the constitutionally required census count, mostly Hispanics. And the result will be that six states will lose Congress people in the U.S. Congress because of the undercount of voters. California, New York, Illinois, Florida, Arizona, particularly all basically six blue congressmen will get the axe if they pull off this, if they add this question. Ross then, he said, well, he had no choice because the Justice Department told him it's something he had to do for some reason. It turns out on investigation that he told the Justice Department to send him a note ordering him to put this question on the census. Now, where did he get this idea? Because Wilbur Ross doesn't have many ideas these days of his own. It came from two people you may have heard of. We've talked about Chris Kobach of Kansas, and for short, we'll just say KKK. Chris Kobach of Kansas came up with this idea of a citizenship question. And second, Chris Kobach, it was Steve Bannon, also told Ross, put that on the census, because they knew exactly what would happen. And, you know, you have to understand, the census, the main census never had this question for everyone. On the long form, as it's called, we asked some people, about 50 years ago, we were asking people this question on a randomly selected group of citizens and people voting. Remember, the census is about counting people. It's not about counting citizens. This is very, very important. What does this have to do with voting? Chris Kobach, who called me and told me that this was his idea, by the way, Chris Kobach told me that and has said on Fox News, he's right up front, if people answer the census form and saying, I'm not a citizen, or people in my household are non-citizens, but they're registered to vote, aha, now we've got what he says are 2 million illegal aliens registered to vote. In fact, he said 1 million of those illegal alien registered voters voted for Hillary Clinton. 1 million. Now, by the way, he hasn't caught any. It's a federal crime, and if you show up to vote and your name's on the roll and you got your address, it should be easy to find these people. He even said it should be easy to find these people. There's 1 million of these illegal voters, 2 million on the roll. He hasn't found them. He says, here's how we'll find them, using the census. That is the ultimate trick, and what they are doing is, we've seen this before with his cross-check list and with his prior alien voter hunts. What he will do is say, oh, there's a Jose Garcia in Florida. By the way, this is a real case. Jose Garcia in Florida. And there was a Jose Garcia who was deported, must be the same Jose Garcia, therefore illegal voter, throw them off the voter rolls. But now they'll say, oh, Jose Garcia said, I am not a citizen, I'm just here on a green card, and then Jose Garcia, another Jose Garcia somewhere else is registered to vote. They'll say, aha, Jose Garcia, take him off the voter rolls. So we know the game that's being played.
Wow. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. We're speaking with Greg Palast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And we've been working together for years now, trying to report on stories that put your vote in jeopardy. And the biggest story, and variations on a theme, is that this guy Kobach, this serial white supremacist, is back again and again. And it doesn't matter that he lost the election for governor. He's got some serious power here.
Well, in fact, one thing that seemed to pass over the heads of the lamestream media is that Trump's lawyer, the Solicitor General, said the reason we are doing this is to help enforce the Voting Rights Act. That should have sent off alarm bells. Instead, people laughed. Ha, you're using the Voting Rights Act as an excuse. That's not funny. Because what the Voting Rights Act and the National Voter Registration Act say is that the voter rolls must be accurate. Now, that would mean allowing every citizen to vote. That's what you and I think. But from their view, it's their excuse to go through the voter rolls using the census. Now, I know you're going to get 25 emails within the next 5 seconds saying, wait, but isn't the census private? There is something called Title 13 of the U.S. Code, which for decades has now said the census is private, that it can't be used by the FBI or anyone else. Well, guess what? USA Patriot Act, Section 215, according to a memo to Eric Holder, says indeed that the exception is national security. And if you are looking for the census records of non-U.S. persons, that's in the Patriot Act. The census is not safe when there are non-U.S. persons involved, and that is specifically anyone who marks, I'm not a citizen, but I'm living here, or I have non-citizens living here, as I do, by the way. I have two non-citizens living with me right now. But I'd have to answer on the census. They're not illegal or anything else. But what it's doing is scaring. It's also, they know it's going to scare away voters. And this is very, very dangerous stuff. So it's not according, and by the way, that information comes from the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the amicus brief they sent to the court, EPIC. And guess what? Who's used this exception before? A young radical right attorney in the Department of Homeland Security named Chris Kobach. It was Chris Kobach who came up with the Arab tracking, the system for tracking Arab Americans using the census, and also using other databases to track Arabs moving around the United States, Arabs and Muslim, under the USA Patriot Act. George Bush W. personally ordered that the Kobach Arab tracking system be shut down. How about that? We had to rely on W to protect our civil liberties from Kobach. Now Kobach has the ear. In fact, he's practically doing a lap dance with the president. Kobach was appointed by Trump to run his so-called voter fraud committee. They're very close. And in fact, if it weren't for Chris Kobach's voting shenanigans, Trump wouldn't be president. And he knows it. And this is the program for, basically, this is the kickoff of Trump's reelection campaign.
All right. Also, the kickoff is sort of the collapse of the Russiagate frenzy. And the sort of distraction that it created from the Clinton machine that was only interested in proving that the reason they lost to this ridiculous man named Donald Trump is because she was such a horrible candidate. So now what? Should they now be focused on? Are they serious? I guess the first action of the House was to think about voter security, but again, it was about Russia. It wasn't about the internal possibilities that we talk about when we talk about Kris Kobach and Trump and what they have in mind for the voter.
Well, I would like to remind you that the only reason Nancy Pelosi was reelected Speaker of the House was that she promised the insurgents and the young insurgents in the Democratic Party that she would make voting rights issue number one in the House. In fact, they passed a bill which they knew wouldn't go through the Senate called H.R. 1 to protect voting rights. So after she did a little song and dance about voting rights to keep her job, it's been pretty much dropped. And they're back to still trying to figure out what they can do with the Mueller report, obstruction of justice, etc. You know, I mean, I don't make light of these things, but when we talk about how the election was manipulated, it wasn't from Moscow. How many times do we have to say this? And, you know, and it's not a few Facebook ads. There was, 100,000 Facebook ads or something in that area, or even less. That's the extreme amount. And most of that, by the way, done after the election. That's nothing in a campaign where over $2 billion was spent, most of it by Hillary Clinton. It was about suppressing the vote. We had using just Kris Kobach's cross-check system when I was did the investigation for Rolling Stone, and I put together a whole team of statisticians. It was 1.1 million voters. It concentrated in places like Ohio, Michigan, which Trump supposedly won by 10,700 votes, Georgia, North Carolina, and we see the effects of these vote suppression systems created by Kobach. In the supposed loss of Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and who is the one candidate, the only major Democratic Party candidate who has said, I'm conceding that I'm not governor, but I didn't lose the election. She specifically last week cited my calculation that 340,134 Georgians were illegally and wrongly removed from the voter rolls, and that was by a scheme created by Kris Kobach of Kansas for his buddy Brian Kemp of Georgia. This is dangerous stuff, because once they have the census, one, not just scaring away people, but access to the census. This is dangerous, dangerous. I would note that that Tom Hartman, because he's afraid that people will be scared from filling out their census form, don't do that. That's like saying, they're going to steal my vote, so I'm not going to register to vote. No, we need everyone to fill out the census form. Don't answer the citizenship question. If no one answers, it becomes worthless to them.
Right.
And
that's
I usually don't. I don't endorse candidates, but I can endorse a civil liberties action. And that is, don't answer that question. Don't.
I also, in the context of covering elections, the corporate press has a lot of responsibility. I mean, they essentially, the corporate executives at MSNBC and CNN bragged about how much money they made on Trump, building him up and taking him down. There was some estimate, very reliable, I'm not sure if it came out of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting or whatever, that Trump got, when you added it all together, 50 times more coverage, Trump and his family, than all the other Republican candidates. 50 times more. How does that compare to a few ads on Facebook?
And in addition, I mean, Hillary Clinton did spend well over $1 billion on ads. $1 billion. I mean, see, she can't say that it was a couple Facebook ads. I mean, look, there's no question that, and Putin has said, he preferred Donald Trump, who said, he'd like to reset the relationship with Russia. We have a lot of nations which kind of stuck their little fingers into the election, from China to Israel to Saudi Arabia. We know that. But in the end, what really made the difference, and we can calculate it name by name, is the removal of voters of color from the voter rolls in particular, and the blockading of the count of the vote. And this new gimmick is not being understood as a way to reach into the voter rolls and another way to remove voters, even if things like where Kobach is saying, even if they can't reach into those voter rolls, into the census directly, into a direct comparison with the voter rolls, but clearly they can. I mean, even Eric Holder has said they can, okay, the Attorney General under Obama. But even beyond that, they can still get that supposed phony information showing, oh, look at all these non-Americans, and yet there's all these people clearly with names that match those who are registered to vote. And it's going to be like a kind of electoral pogrom. And this is not, the voting aspect is not being discussed, even though it was, interestingly, like I said, Trump's own lawyer who brought it up and said the reason for doing this is to protect the voter rolls. No one asked what do you mean by that? You know, it's like what he means by that is something is a new form of electronic fascism and racism, and it's the new Jim Crow in cyberspace. This is what we have to worry about right now, and so I'm very concerned. And again, don't let this stop you from filling out the census form, because then they win by reducing your voting power, the number of congresspeople you have, the number how you divide state, senate, and assembly districts, how you the electoral votes of the states are affected by this. You lose a congressman, you lose an electoral vote, by the way. Okay, I'm sure Trump doesn't mind California losing two electoral votes. So this is very, very dangerous stuff. So please do fill out the census form. Don't answer the question about citizen.
All right.
Just don't.
Okay, that's Greg Palast. He can be reached and followed at gregpalast.com. He is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. That's a book and a film. Reports for the BBC in the United States, Rolling Stone, and does a great deal of important work in terms of protecting your election, your vote. And we're going to continue our dialogue all the way through 2020. And there's going to be a lot to talk about as we watch this unfold. Greg, thank you.
Thank you, Dennis Bernstein. That's from Flashpoints from, I think it was Wednesday of this week. So, 24th. Flashpoints.net. Look around at some of the other stuff they've done. They did a Earth Day special. That was pretty neat. So, now going to a podcast. I didn't have to bleep anything this time. It was a public event in D.C. They talk about it as the alt opening, because the venue at Busboys and Poets was pressured to not happen. Moderate Rebels. The book is, the book will be well explained here, so why don't I let them get on and we'll hear about what Helena Cobbin says about early activities by then Representative John McCain down in Arizona, where people were sponsoring a mujahideen, like, you know, sponsor a child abroad, sponsor a freedom fighter. It covers a lot of this history and blowback phenomena, regime change machinations, what happens. Ben Norton and Mr. Blumenthal, Max. They mention a book by Rashid Khalidi. No? Ahmed Rashid. A guy who, can't remember the name of the book, but it was a good one. Helena Cobbin, I think I've read articles, but she has a major book out as well. She's a longtime scholar of the Middle East, Cobban. You'll hear her in her giveaway English accent. One of the contributions that I've listened to from the audience. I commend this to your attention. Moderate Rebels.
This is the alternative book launch. You could call it the alt launch. All of you know the backstory on why we're here. I just called Brian as soon as I had learned that there were some other troubles with the other location, Politics and Prose, who are here. And I think we should also give Politics and Prose a round of applause for supporting this event. They faced a braying mob, and that's why I brought Ben here as my personal security to defend me.
I've been lifting. You can probably
Yeah, and we're here to talk about the most dangerous book in D.C., which is my book, The Management of Savagery. For those of you who don't know, Ben and I have been doing a podcast called Moderate Rebels. That's a term that comes up in the book a lot. Obviously, it's used ironically in the context of our podcast. And this is a live taping of Moderate Rebels, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Ben has been a sort of off and on staff writer of The Gray Zone since, 2017? And that's when we started really coming under attack from the same forces that appear on the pages of my book, and which lobbied to basically cancel my entire book tour in the online version of a book burning. So Ben has really contributed, I think, to opening up the discussion on regime change wars and how humanitarian interventionist propaganda is deployed. And Ben, I don't know if you want to...
Well, I think it's also a reflection of the fact, and we'll get to this later on, but the people actively lobbying for the U.S. government to wage war on Syria, among other nations, they have resorted to trying to ban books that they find that they dislike. And that's a reflection of the fact that, one, that some of those wars have failed, but also that we're in a moment in which we're in an information war, and journalism is no longer seen as something to inform the public, to help them make better decisions about their lives and govern society, but it's seen as warfare. And if you report facts that they don't like, you're acting on behalf of some government, et cetera, or some interest. And that's what Max's book is about. So one of the things we want to do with this conversation is we're going to keep it kind of conversational. We're also going to welcome input from the audience at different points. And we're going to try to keep it more fun, right? Because we don't want to just have a book event where, you know, it's just Max bloviating and you listening. We want
like
to do
all actually, my other book events.
Like every other book event ever. So, and also because there's a sense of humor in the book itself. I mean, if you know Max, you'll probably know that he's basically a failed comedian, but he's still pretty funny. You know, so you can see that in the book. You can see that in our show, Moderate Rebels. You can see that in his writing. And I guess we'll go ahead and start. And one of the things we want to do beginning is just kind of reflect on the moment we're in right now. And I think, you know, what's funny is in the era of Trumpism, liberals have kind of co-opted this idea that this is not normal, right? But I think we should reflect on the fact that we are in a very bizarre time, and this book encapsulates just how bizarre this is, where we have former national security state officials who are responsible for the deaths of millions of people, for orchestrating the Iraq War, for orchestrated countless other wars, who are now being seen and portrayed as members of the progressive resistance against Donald Trump, right? And ironically, these are the same figures who have helped to give birth to Donald Trump, to give birth to the far right and these other forces that have metastasized, not just throughout the US, but through Europe and much of the world. Max's book really encapsulates that rather succinctly. It might not seem like it at 400 pages, but actually he spells out conflict by conflict how this has happened. And we see it right now today, just thinking about what's going on with Russiagate. You know, Russiagate has collapsed. Robert Mueller, the special counsel, has been unable to find evidence proving collusion between Trump and the Russian government. And this narrative was relied on for 2 years now by the Democratic Party, by the Hillary Clinton campaign and others, as this kind of cudgel to prevent any movement to the left, to attack progressive critics, and to portray anyone who is critical of the neoliberal democratic establishment as some kind of Russian agent. And now that that has come collapsing down, we can see very clearly that this narrative the entire time was a national security state narrative being pushed by US intelligence services. So we're going to start there and talk about how his book, you know, we're going to go through the different conflicts, the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, the Gulf War, the Iraq War, the war in Syria, and these are all inextricably linked, of course. But to think about the time we're in right now, with Donald Trump, this far-right billionaire reality TV show president, the intelligence agencies and the Democratic Party have resorted to rehabilitating the national security state. So maybe we can start there, Max, talking about this moment we're in before we go to understand the historical context that led us here.
Yeah, I think that Russiagate, which is, you know, partially collapsed, but which still will continue on and which will be inevitably used to suppress the popularity of Bernie Sanders, is the product of a confluence of factors. And you know, most people who have been Russiagate skeptics have been really good at pointing out the role of MSNBC in kind of becoming the Fox News for Democrats, propagandizing people night after night with Rachel Maddow warning that Russia can actually turn off our heat in the winter. And that's the easy stuff. That emanated from, you know, the Hillary Clinton campaign, where we know from this meeting in the book Shattered, which is an insider's account of the Hillary campaign and its collapse, that Robbie Mook and these other characters basically decided to push the Russiagate narrative immediately and blame Russian hackers, WikiLeaks, and I think there was something else that didn't really relate to the reality of their failure. But this was also a counterintelligence operation. We've now learned, now that George Papadopoulos, who is sort of like Trump's coffee boy, you know, the Trump campaign was a pirate ship and you had all these bizarre characters from Papadopoulos, who I used to think was Webster's dad, if you're young enough to remember the TV show Webster, to Sebastian Gorka, you know, who appears on election night wearing a Vitezi Rend, a Hungarian fascist outfit.
Nazi collaborator.
He's sort of like supporting a Nazi collaborator as a character who basically faked his PhD in so many ways. We'll talk about that later. And he appears in the pages of my book. But Papadopoulos actually talks about how as soon as he became attached to the Trump campaign, he was approached by mysterious figures like George Mifsud, who I think Elizabeth Leavas has demonstrated pretty conclusively is likely an MI5 asset. And Stefan Halper, a confidential FBI and CIA asset, were inserted into the Trump campaign. You actually had Carter Page spied on by the NSA on the basis of the Christopher Steele dossier, which according to one of its longtime proponents, the journalist Michael Isikoff, is basically a bunch of bunk. It's basically been exposed as bunk, but those of us who read it knew it. We knew it was bunk from the beginning. That's why we became kind of the Russiagate skeptics, because we knew there was never going to be a conclusive finding by Mueller of collusion. And then you have the neocons, figures like William Kristol, Bill Kristol, who has been, you know, had his reputation rehabilitated thanks to Russiagate.
On MSNBC, he was hanging out with Fat Joe.
Yeah, Ari Melber, a guy I used to work with at The Nation, is seen on MSNBC hyping up woke Bill Kristol, and they're bobbing their heads to hip-hop along with the faded rapper Fat Joe riding through downtown New York, and it's like the master of the macabre in Iraq, who has blood on his hands, is now woke Bill Kristol, according to this progressive I used to work with. This is, you know, what Russiagate has done for Kristol. But I write about in my afterword, which is about Russiagate and the role of Syria and Russiagate, I write about how Bill Kristol in 2014 was fretting about a war-weary public. The American public was not supportive enough of war, and he said that there needed to be a rallying in the pages of the Weekly Standard, which is now defunct and resuscitated thanks to the billions of Piero Omidyar in a different form. And Bill Kristol had an outfit in town called the Foreign Policy Initiative, which was the reboot of the Project for a New American Century, which provided a home for a lot of the Iraq War ideologues. And in one of the first stories I did on the revival of the Cold War back in 2014, I wrote about the Foreign Policy Initiative orchestrating the resignation of an RT anchor who was previously unknown, Liz Wall, through its fellow Jamie Kirchick, who's another kind of middling neocon in town working under Kristol's watch. And they orchestrated this resignation on RT in order to essentially make RT a target of a counterintelligence investigation, which culminated with its registration as a foreign agent. And this was, to me, one of the opening shots in the new Cold War. It followed the coup in Maidan, which led to the annexation of Crimea after a referendum in which over 80% of Crimeans who are Russian speakers voted to join Russia. But something was brewing. And so Russiagate was sort of inevitable in many ways, and Trump really made it possible, partly because he was speaking a non-interventionist language on the campaign trail. I think Steve Bannon recognized that the Rust Belt voters and the people in Ohio and Michigan, the workers, the supposed white working class, who bore the moral injury of the war in Iraq, would respond if someone took down the Bush family, would respond if someone openly trashed John McCain, who's actually not liked by a lot of all Vietnam veterans. And they did. And they responded when Trump countered Hillary Clinton, who called for a no-fly zone in Syria, which she privately admitted in one of her Goldman Sachs paid talks would kill a lot of Syrians. And Trump said, we don't even know who we're arming in Syria. Trump got, he tapped into the strong non- and anti-interventionism of middle America, and that scared the hell out of the managers of savagery in Washington. So Russiagate served the purpose of domesticating Trump, first removing Michael Flynn as his national security advisor, not exactly a figure who I would describe as a non-interventionist or necessarily a sane individual. But Flynn, how was he dimed out? Well, the NSA was listening to him. I think an NSA official informed someone like Lisa Page or Sally Yates, who then went to the Washington Post columnist David Ignatius, who wrote about a U.S. official writing about Michael Flynn talking with the Russian ambassador. And the American public gets the sense, especially liberals who are already hepped up on Russophobia, that Flynn is having this secret conversation with the Russian ambassador about collusion, about selling out the American public, which they've been hearing about. In fact, what Flynn was talking about with Sergei Kislyak was Israel and protecting Israel at the UN. Flynn had called Kislyak on behalf of Jared Kushner, who is himself acting as the sort of Sherpa of Benjamin Netanyahu, to ask him to block a vote, to ask him to be the deciding vote because Obama was going to abstain at the UN on that Security Council vote on Israeli settlements. And so it was all about Israel, and it's all about Israelgate, but the American public didn't know that for over a year. So Flynn is replaced with H.R. McMaster. Who's H.R. McMaster? I mean, he's the perfect representative of the national security state, someone who emerged under the watch of David Petraeus, a counterinsurgency expert, someone who favors, more tanks, more land wars, conventional wars, someone who was leaking on Trump up until the day he was fired. And so you see the gradual domestication of the Trump administration under the narrative of Russiagate, to the point where he's surrounded by the very same Bush neocons that he had campaigned against, down to Elliot Abrams. So we can come back to that, but I think Russiagate has played a really negative role for those of us who actually favor peace, a word you very rarely hear in presidential campaigns anymore. I think only one candidate, Tulsi Gabbard, uses that word. I rarely hear Bernie use it. But also Russiagate has proven the point of my book, which is that the national security state helps the far right again and again and again. And what have they done by putting all their eggs in the collusion basket and building everything up to Mueller's report? Is they've helped Trump, because now Trump, in the words of his former campaign manager and chief of staff Steve Bannon, is going to go full animal on his opponents now that Mueller essentially has concluded that there was no collusion and recommended no indictments, and essentially made all of Trump's most fervent foes look like a bunch of conspiracy theorists, which they were all along. So once again, they've helped Trump. I think Trump is the favorite to win re-election in the upcoming election. And if he does win, all the people that put all their eggs in Mueller's basket and made Mueller into like this national sex symbol, to the point where the New Yorker was featuring photographs of him and talking about his Brooks Brothers suit and what cologne he wears, those people will bear responsibility for Trump's re-election, when they could have been talking about class issues, economic issues, Trump's racism, his war on immigrants. They could have been talking about his dastardly coup in Venezuela. They could have been talking about his cruel sanctions on Iran and the destabilization of the Middle East. They could have been talking about Trump appointing Herman Cain to the Fed, but basically Godfather Pizza CEO is gonna run the Fed. I mean, this buffoonery has all been covered in a narrative that has brought us to a new Cold War.
Yeah, and this is why we began with this, because this is only, again, further confirmation of the thesis of Max's book, which is that the U.S. national security state, which we can understand, there's been this discussion recently of what the people call the deep state, as if this is a new concept. This has, of course, been around for many decades. It's referred to many other countries, Turkey, famously, but other countries. Many states have a deep state, which is really how you maintain a governing apparatus, especially when you're an empire, in between different heads of state. So the Pentagon, the CIA, all these institutions have people who stay within, largely within their office from term to term. They're seen as kind of apolitical parts, maintainers, apparatchiks, right, who maintain the apparatus of the US empire. And the point is that these people who work within the US national security state have for years supported on and off far-right forces throughout the world, and now those forces have come back to bite, not just us, but of course many of the people that the US has targeted. So I think one of the other ways we can get into that topic is talking about the title of the book, because you know this is actually a very interesting topic. I'm going to quote from part of the book. This title, The Management of Savagery, is from a paper written by a Salafi jihadi theorist, if you will.
Ideologue.
Who went by Abu Bakr Najm.
Many suspect it was actually Ayman al-Zawahiri who wrote this, but it was authored under the name of an Iraqi Salafi jihadi ideologue.
And you can talk more about it, but Max writes, and I think this really encapsulates what we just talked about with Russiagate, but also with the other issues we'll talk about. Max pointed out that this Salafi paper, The Management of Savagery, quote, dovetailed neatly with the regime change blueprints conceived by national security hardliners in Washington. And it hints at the symbiotic relationship that these two extremist elements have enjoyed. In Libya and Syria, where the CIA provided arms and equipment to jihadist insurgents, this ideological symbiosis was consolidated through direct collaboration. But as I will demonstrate in the coming pages, savagery, by its very definition, cannot be managed. In fact, it has already found its way back home. What do you mean by that, Max?
Well, when I talk about this document, I first kind of analyze the strategy behind it, which is to move beyond what Al-Qaeda's traditional strategy had been, vexation and exhaustion, which is simply the kind of terror attacks we saw, for example, in Mumbai, spectacular acts of terror, the Charlie Hebdo attack, and to actually establish administrations of savagery, something that was made possible thanks to the U.S. occupation of Iraq, places like Camp Buko, where you had the people who knew how to run a police state, who worked under Saddam Hussein, who had been de-Ba'athified, joining up with figures like Abu Bakr Baghdadi, who eventually became ISIS's self-proclaimed caliph. And by establishing administrations of savagery, they would then begin breaking down these post-colonial, previously stable Arab states like Syria and Libya. Chechnya and Afghanistan are named as partial successes that were made possible, first of all, thanks to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But they failed to move from the administration of savagery into the Islamic State that this mysterious figure, Najee, outlined. And so Syria would be essentially the test of that, where they would try to set up an Islamic State. But I liken this document to the documents that we saw tumbling out of neoconservative think tanks in 1996 at the height of unipolar American triumphalism, when the US had declared victory over the Soviet Union, when we thought, or our foreign policy elites thought, they could do anything here. And so we saw a call for benevolent hegemony from Robert Kagan, who would go on to advise both Mitt Romney and Hillary Clinton, even hosting a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, and Bill Kristol, who we just talked about. And you also had the clean break strategy put forward by two big pro-Israel ideologues, Likudnik ideologues, Richard Perle and Douglas Feith, who had worked out of the office, actually, of a Democrat, Scoop Jackson, in the 1970s. And this was their strategy, their regional strategy, that they offered Benjamin Netanyahu as he entered the prime minister's office for a first time. And if you look at that document, it looks very similar to the management of strategy. It's about fragmenting all of the post-colonial Arab states that surround Israel and that are resisting its and the US's sphere of influence. And they actually call explicitly in that document for weaponizing Sunni Arab tribes in northeastern Syria against the government in Damascus. Well, this is 1996. What happened later? Some almost two decades later, those Sunni Arab tribes were weaponized by the Islamic State, and that they established their first caliphate in northeastern Syria, their administration of savagery in Raqqa, through an invasion of Raqqa by Jabhat al-Nusra, which was the Al-Qaeda affiliate at the time, acting as a Trojan horse for what would become the Islamic State, and the Free Syrian Army, which was armed and trained by the CIA, the so-called moderate rebels. So they did it thanks to the weapons farm that the US set up. And that was, Obama was fully warned about that in a Defense Intelligence Agency document signed off on by one Michael Flynn, which warned of a Salafist principality being established imminently thanks to the US arm and equip program of the FSA and their allies in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, something that came to bear in 2013.
And of course, this war created the largest refugee crisis since the end of World War II, which in turn fueled the rise of far-right, xenophobic, and Islamophobic forces in Europe, in the US, and elsewhere. So we want to get to Syria and talk about how all these things are linked. And this is the point that Max makes again and again in his book. And he looks at several conflicts. And here we're going to kind of briefly go through some of those conflicts to see how it's the same tactic where the US national security state, through the CIA, also through soft power groups like USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, support the moderate rebels, right? The far-right forces in countries they want to destabilize that they refer to as moderate beacons of democracy. And then those forces later, either when they come into power, perpetuate these kinds of acts of terror that we see, or they come and blow back. And we can talk about the war in Afghanistan, which is what we'll look at first. The classic case that gave birth to many of these forces we see today. The war in Afghanistan, which was one of the most important and one of the final wars of the Cold War, one of the most important proxy conflicts in the 1980s, gave birth to not just the far-right Salafi forces we see, like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but also to some of the same far-right political forces we have seen that are metastasizing through Europe. So, Max, you were talking about how we're living through a kind of new Cold War today. And it's not just me saying that. You can look at the new national security strategy drafted by the U.S. Defense Department that they released last year, 2 years ago now, that says that the new goals that the U.S. needs to overcome for national security, it's not undermining and fighting non-state terrorism.
ISIS isn't even mentioned.
Well, it's mentioned as the third most important priority. The most important priority now, according to the U.S. national security official strategy, is countering what they call revisionist powers, which are China and Russia. That is, those are the words of former Defense Secretary Mattis. He said, great power competition is now our primary threat, not non-state and terror. And then the second threat on this hierarchy of supposed threats would be countries like Iran, the DPRK, Syria, Venezuela, and then the third would be non-state actors. So we have re-entered a kind of new Cold War. We were talking about information war. We've seen Russiagate. And in order to understand how we got here and how the far right has come into power in multiple countries, we have to go back to the end of the first Cold War, and specifically the war in Afghanistan. So Max, explain why we need to understand the war in Afghanistan and why it's so important today.
Yeah, the war in Afghanistan, the proxy war, is a model for so much of what we see today, down to the information war that we're victimized by. It was the product of a decision. I mean, I think it was inevitable because the U.S. had embarked on a very similar, under the Carter administration, had embarked on a very similar great power competition, and it decided to kind of weaken the second tier powers in order to bleed the first tier, the Soviet Union. And Afghanistan was one of them. So Zbigniew Brzezinski, national security advisor to Carter, someone whose family comes from Galicia, which is now partly in western Ukraine, which is a base of Ukrainian nationalism and part of a new U.S. proxy war.
Also from the Polish nobility, and of course his daughter is a leading host on MSNBC.
And you know, so his family were landowners. They were extreme anti-communists. He had a personal vested stake in taking down the Soviet Union by any means, and he talked about an arc of crisis in the Third World, where the Soviet Union was actually helping to stabilize certain states that had suffered from poverty and winning them as its own allies, and he sought to replace it in Afghanistan with what he called an arc of Islam. Which would actually prove to be very destabilizing. This meant funding people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was essentially an extremist warlord and a drug dealer who helped later flood later flood Russia with heroin. I interviewed Vincent Canestraro, who was the former CIA counterintelligence operative who knew Hekmatyar. He referred to him as Gulbud. He knew him so well. He helped bring him to Washington, where Hekmatyar actually refused to meet with Reagan. Under Reagan's watch, the budget for the Afghan proxy war was doubled. It was the largest covert operation in CIA history. Over $1 billion, Operation Cyclone.
And for some more context here, just so you know, so what happens is, in Afghanistan, you have a revolution on the rise of a socialist government that is allied with the Soviet Union, and the strategy that Brzezinski later admitted was to try to lure the Soviet Union into Afghanistan by supporting these far-right Islamist groups in what he called the Afghan trap, that was Brzezinski's language, in order to encourage what is now always referred to as the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan that was requested by the socialist government at the time of Afghanistan. It was an explicit trap that was meant to bleed the Soviet Union, as Max says, at its soft underbelly, if you look at where it is geopolitically, and the U.S. allied with pleasant, great people like Hekmatyar, who was notorious for throwing acid in the face of women.
This actually took place, the throwing of acid in the faces of women took place at Kabul University. Hekmatyar was one of the so-called professors, along with Burhanuddin Rabbani, who were actually supported by the CIA back then in the early 70s through a front group called the Asia Foundation in order to weaken the student movement for socialism in Afghanistan, which was sort of a nationalist movement at its core. And that eventually culminated with the Arm and Equip program that the CIA, in which the CIA gave over $600 million to this fanatic and caused one of the first major refugee crises after the Cold War, which Pakistani intelligence sort of benefited from. And Pakistani intelligence was involved in this operation. The Saudis were involved in this operation with a matching fund, and it helped consolidate the U.S. special relationship with Saudi Arabia. And it also provided Saudi Arabia with a net benefit, which was that they were able to take, you know, you have the royal family, these guys who like to hang out on yachts, like Mohammed bin Salman actually was caught drinking tequila with The Rock. And they are hated by the Wahhabi clergy and by a large slice of their population that's deeply pious and religious. So they were able to ventilate the internal crisis by sending young men over to the Pakistani border to a place in Peshawar maintained and funded by a young Osama bin Laden, who was one of those young figures. It was called the Services Bureau. Bin Laden was working with a Palestinian named Abdullah Azam to send foreign fighters onto the Afghan battlefield.
It's important to keep in mind a Palestinian who left the Palestinian resistance movement because he didn't like it because it was too progressive.
Too secular.
And so then he moved to Saudi Arabia and engaged in these reactionary political forces and worked with the CIA.
Essentially what takes place is, by 1989, the Red Army is forced to leave. Mohammad Najibullah, who is their proxy, this sort of communist figure in Kabul, remains and decides to fight it out with his own army against Ahmed Shah Massoud, Burhanuddin Rabbani, and Hekmatyar. He's eventually removed. And then you have a war of the warlords, a war of all against all, bristling with U.S. weapons, and half of Kabul is destroyed. The refugee crisis is worsened. The opium and heroin crisis across Europe is worsened. And all of Afghanistan is destabilized. This is the 1990s. The U.S. is looking to pay Hekmatyar still protection money to guard UNICAL's pipeline to the Caspian Sea. The relationship is still there. And then you have what Jack Bloom, who was the investigator for the Senate Select Committee under John Kerry, of Iran-Contra, and this whole sad saga referred to me as the disposal problem, where figures like bin Laden come back to Saudi Arabia as a hero because this, you know, scion of wealth and aristocracy, he's seen in caves with an army suit. He's seen as a badass, and he comes back, and he's a hero. And other figures are coming back not just to their home countries, whether it's to the Philippines to form the Abu Sayyaf group, or to Bosnia to fight in another US proxy war, or to Chechnya. They're coming back to New York City. And here I'm talking about Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh, who was sent actually to the Afghan battlefield on a CIA flight and entered the US to New York on a CIA visa after Abdullah Azzam, the Palestinian former head of the Services Bureau, was mysteriously killed in a car bomb because he was refusing to participate in the new strategy of this group, which was to kill Muslims who were takfir, who were not religiously proper, to go after secular-oriented governments, like the government of Mubarak in Egypt, like the government of Assad in Syria. And Azzam said, I won't kill other Muslims. He killed. Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh, takes over the Services Bureau's outfit in New York City, and the Services Bureau as a whole morphs into Al-Qaeda internationally. Al-Qaeda means the base, and it was named after the base that bin Laden, Azzam, and Zawahiri had maintained in Afghanistan. And they embark on their strategy of vexation. But meanwhile, you have this outfit in New York called the Al-Kifa Center, which is the Services Bureau's local office, operating under the watch of the FBI and the CIA. And it's guys who were trained in military-style tactics in Afghanistan and were being sent back to other battlefields to help the US, for example, destabilize Yugoslavia and Bosnia. And they were also being taken to a gun range in Long Island by a triple agent named Ali Abdul Sud Mohammed, who was sent into New York by Zawahiri, who was simultaneously working for the CIA and FBI.
Known as Ali the American.
And so, you know, just before we get into him, I mean, you think about it, there actually was a de facto Al-Qaeda cell in New York City in the 1990s. It's sort of like an Islamophobe's wet dream. The thing is, it was operating under the watch of the CIA and still performing this service for the CIA while Al-Qaeda was being ignored in national security circles in the US. I found one of the first references to Osama bin Laden in American media in the Washington Post, I think it was in 1995. And it was about how he was through the so-called Golden Chain and a series of charities like Benevolence International and another charity whose name I forget, sending money to the battlefield in Bosnia, and that the Clinton administration had instructed investigators to essentially lay off because their priority was to break down another stable socialist-oriented state that resisted its sphere of influence.
Yeah, and related to that, many of you might have seen, there's an infamous now article by Robert Fisk, who's actually an amazing award-winning Middle East reporter, that he infamously published in The Independent in 1993. It has a large photo of Osama bin Laden, and it's called Osama bin Laden, Anti-Soviet Warrior, Puts His Army on the Road to Peace. And it talks about how Osama bin Laden was working as a kind of loyal US proxy in Afghanistan to destabilize the Soviet Union. So I think we're getting a little in the weeds here, but let's look at the bigger picture. So it's important to understand the origins of these groups, like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, in this war, this war that was a proxy conflict in the larger Cold War, to fight against the Soviet Union, to fight against progressive, socialist, and communist forces. And also something that you stress in your book is that were it not for these conflicts, we would not be in the age we're in now of the war on terror, and we would not have had 9/11. In fact, I want to read a section from this book because it actually is a good segue to understand what brought us to the hellish state we're in the world. Over now, you know, almost two decades into the war on terror, and you have a section in the beginning, and you write, "This book makes the case that Trump's election would not have been possible without 9/11 and the subsequent military interventions conceived by the national security state that have fueled these far-right forces." And you say, "Further, I argue that if the CIA had not spent over $1 billion arming Islamist militants in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War, empowering jihadi godfathers like Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden in the process, the 9/11 attacks would have almost certainly not taken place. And if the Twin Towers were still standing today, it is not hard to imagine an alternative political universe in which a demagogue like Trump was still relegated to real estate and reality TV." So this brings us, so we have understood that throughout this war, in the Reagan, beginning in the Carter years and in the Reagan years, when the US was arming Contras and far-right death squads in Nicaragua, it was arming the equivalent in Afghanistan. You talk rather comically of this program that the US had called Adopt a Mujahid. And it was where these Republicans, these white Republicans, were just like, yeah, I adopted a Mujahid fighter, which is the Arabic word for jihadist, a jihadist fighter from Afghanistan who were fighting.
Well, it essentially means a freedom fighter and not necessarily the way we popularly understand it. But this was my source on that story, is sitting in the front row, Helena Cobbin. You went to this conference you could talk about it now real briefly, but you went to this conference in Tucson, keynoted by a young, hard-charging freshman congressman named John McCain, and Republican women were, adopting a Muj.
Yeah, you got it. These kind of very elderly, rich women with too many facelifts, you know, and like wanting to feel, you know, that they have the attention of some young, virile, whatever. And, you know, they were standing there with their Muj, wearing sort of, you know, a Muj outfit, which involves that funny floppy hat. And it was quite the thing on the Tucson, Arizona social circuit at the time.
and infamously Rambo 3, you can find this online, the film is just a propaganda film for the Afghan Mujahideen, and at the end of the movie, it says, this film is dedicated to the brave, heroic fighters of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Of course, these are the ancestors that gave birth, as he mentioned, to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and as Max documents in his book, when the Taliban took over Kabul and consolidated control over Afghanistan, there was a press briefing in which the State Department welcomed it, and the response was, well, we think that they'll construct a state similar to Saudi Arabia. You know, it's not going to be that bad, and for our interests, it's fine. So that brings us, of course, to 9/11, because yeah, these
we'll
are the
we'll great... The actual quote by the State Department official was, I think, to Ahmed Rashid, the reporter, and he said, we'll get Aramco, we'll get an Aramco-like pipeline and Sharia law, and we can live with that. Another special relationship, the U.S. actually did support, initially, the Taliban, because they provided some modicum of stability when the warlords that the CIA had backed had torn everything apart. And there were many average Afghans who actually supported it as well, because they were sick of living in a war of all against all. But building up to 9/11, I mean, what Ben illustrated was the kind of culture of the Cold War, which we're living again, where these kind of events were seen as commonplace and normal, and these were freedom fighters, in fact. I mean, I learned it from John Rambo. I learned it from Dan Rather, Gunga Dan, according to the Washington Post critic Tom Shales. Dan Rather went and hung out with the Mujahideen and said they don't have enough bullets, they have Enfield rifles, they're fighting for freedom. You know, what they wound up getting ultimately was quite the opposite, but it was really in the 90s when I think the national security elite in the U.S. started to realize they had a problem on their hands. It was the Tanzania and Kenya bombings carried out by Al-Qaeda against U.S. consulates. And who did the advance, who was sort of the advance man for those bombings, who took the pictures of the locations? Whose pet project was it? It was the person I named earlier, Ali Abdul Sud Muhammad, Ali the American, who was operating under the protection of the FBI and CIA, who had actually trained and lived at Fort Bragg and was part of the JFK School of Special Warfare, operating under the watch of a colonel named Norville Diatkin, who wrote the intro to a very racist Orientalist book called The Arab Mind, which was later used to devise torture tactics against Iraqis and Afghans at Abu Ghraib and Bagram Air Base. And Ali Abdul Sud Muhammad, Ali the American, was giving seminars for army officers about the Arab Mind, overseen by Norville Diatkin, while he was going over to Afghanistan to train with bin Laden's forces at Khos. I actually have here a series of what were then classified documents, these are photocopied, that were spirited out of the JFK School of Special Warfare by Ali Muhammad, who was operating under the protection of our national security state. And he basically annotates them in Arabic. You can see here he's annotating basically how to use an M72 light anti-tank weapon, which is made in the hometown of my friend Dan Cohen back there. You know, you can kind of see it, I'll hold it up. And, you know, this was so Al-Qaeda could use them. Where were they found? They were found in the home of El Said Nosser, who is the assassin of the extremist rabbi Meir Kahana, who was part of the Al-Kifa Center that I talked about before, basically the local office of Al-Qaeda operating under the watch of the CIA. So I interviewed, you know, Nosser was put on trial for that killing. And I interviewed the lawyers who defended Nosser and many of his colleagues, some of whom were mentally disturbed, who were not fit to stand trial. And this was the U.S. attempting to end its disposal problem with this contrived case against them and the blind sheikh to basically put to bed what they had created in Afghanistan in mid-90s New York. And one of the lawyers I interviewed, Roger Stavis, he was a brilliant defense lawyer, he referred to these characters as Team America. And he said, how can you put them on trial? They were loyal soldiers for America's interests. And it's all about Afghanistan, 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 Afghanistan. He learned through this trial about Ali Muhammad. And he sought to call him to testify. And that wasn't going to work with the right-wing lawyer who was a prosecutor, Andrew McCarthy, or Patrick Fitzgerald, who would eventually become the head of Alex Station, the I-49 group that was dedicated to fighting Al-Qaeda. Fitzgerald and McCarthy advised and actually ordered Ali Muhammad to not come back to the trial and to ignore his subpoena because it was so embarrassing for the CIA, because he was still active. The blind sheikh, Omar Abdel-Rahman, was also put on trial. It was a contrived plot that was sort of manufactured by an informant, a confidential informant. And I learned from one of his defense lawyers, Abdin Jabara, that the CIA was initially worried about him being put on trial, and they had actually postponed his prosecution in order to prevent an embarrassment. He was eventually put on trial. An FBI agent who mentioned the fact that he had been trained in Afghanistan was subsequently reassigned right after the trial. So there was this embarrassment. The whole thing was swept under the rug. To make a long story short, Ali Muhammad was eventually put in a witness protection center in a federal prison. He was never allowed to really take the stand. He was registered as John Doe in the federal prison system by 1998. And he reappeared in a very interesting moment that many of you who saw Fahrenheit 9/11 might be familiar with, but you won't be familiar with him as the source of this moment. When George W. Bush was presented with the presidential daily briefing at Crawford, Texas, I think it was on August 15th, remember when the systems were blinking red, and he received a very long PDB. It was a page and a half long, and it said, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the U.S. And if you actually read that document, I hadn't read it until I started doing this book, the source was a former Egyptian Islamic Jihad cadre referring to Ali Muhammad. And everybody he talked about, it was so obvious, he was describing everything he knew from his time as Al-Qaeda's man in the U.S. But that whole scandal remained swept under the rug. Not one journalist pointed to him except for Peter Lance, whose work I tried to revive in my book. So you have Bush, basically he looks at it for like 5 minutes, throws it in the trash can, and they move on. America was in an unusual cultural moment, and I describe that moment in a chapter called Summer of the Shark, where the mainstream media, the corporate media, didn't have anything to scare people with, and so they were losing ratings, which is another factor in Russiagate. And so they came up with the Sharknado of body parts bobbing in the sea, when in fact shark attacks were down from the previous year. And I quote one oceanologist who said that he was receiving over 50 calls a day from reporters looking for news about shark attacks. And then you also had Chandra Levy, which is a local DC story, and Gary Condit dominated the news that summer while the systems were blinking red. Now let me just talk about one other thing that was happening that will illustrate how cynical the national security state has been around 9/11.
Well, you can hear that in whatever speed you choose by going to Moderate Rebels. This is the book launch edition. It was a live recording with a little contribution by Mideast scholar Helena Cobban in there, C-O-B-B-A-N. I was Googling the book, Max Blumenthal, The Management of Savagery, and what comes up first? This past Wednesday, he was supposed to speak at the Seminary Co-op, which I guess also owns 57th Street Books. They come up on the same page. In the University of Chicago area, I guess, because there's also a listing at the arts.chicago.edu. The one at the seminary points out that it's canceled. No explanation. So this past Wednesday, he was supposed to speak near the Chicago, University of Chicago campus, as he called it at the beginning, if you were in for most of that. The most dangerous book in D.C. That was recorded in D.C. Busboys and Poets near DuPont Circle was pressured to not host him. They helped him find an alternate space, the alternate book launch. I don't know if there's an alternate space in Chicago. At the seminarycoop.org website, on this page it just says canceled, there is an RSVP, so when I get on my home computer, I'm going to responde, s'il vous plaît, and ask him, WTF. So the book title is